when it moves into that screwball comedy phase, that's where the film started to lose me, really, because it's meant to be amusing and cute and all that. And I thought, well, if this is cute, I guess it's cute in the early 21st century, but it's not the way a screwball comedy would have been in the 1930s. And it's just, to me, it just seems like taking a genre or flirting with a genre, but with subject matter that, you know, is so seamy that it just doesn't, for me, quite work.
Hello, and welcome to At the Movies with Mike and Marie, a show where two film professors talk about movies. I'm Marie Westhaver.
And I'm Mike Giuliano.
And today we're going to talk about Anora and The Brutalist. Interestingly, you know, last night was the Academy Awards. Both of these films did very well. Both have something to do with trying to achieve the American dream. Mike, why don't you start us off with Anora, which won the Palme d'Or at Cannes and came into the Academy Awards with a lot of buzz.
Yeah, what's interesting about Anora is it had that buzz going back to May of 24, because it did win the Palme d'Or, which is the top prize at the Cannes Film Festival. And then, you know, it was riding on that from that point onward. As we got into Academy Awards season, it certainly was one of the favored films to win. And in fact, you know, people making their predictions often had Anora picked. But we all had to sort of hedge that way. And I'll add my hedging to the other hedging in this respect, in two respects, actually. When a few years ago, the Oscars increased the number of best film nominees from like 5 to 10, suddenly you had such a crowded field, you know, all sorts of possibilities, right? You know, it could go this way, that way, what have you. That's the one thing to consider. And the second, and this hasn't been as widely publicized as it might be, is that Oscar voters now have ranked voting. And that makes it more complicated because, and I'll present this as a hypothetical. There might be a film that only gets a minority of first place votes, like, yeah, this is the one, this is our winner. But there might be a number of other voters who say, well, I don't have it as number one, but I have it as number two or number three. So hypothetically, at least, you could have a film that doesn't get that many first place votes, but gets a lot of second and third place votes. And I can only say that hypothetically because I'm not privy to the exact breakdown on the vote. But that's why even when people recently ask me, who do you think is going to win? I was hemming and hawing, and well, maybe this or that. And, you know, certainly Anora was a strong possibility. Now, to your direct question, yes, it did very well at the Oscars. It won 5 Academy Awards. So for the record, Best Picture, Director for Sean Baker, Actress for Mikey Madison, Original Screenplay also for Sean Baker. He did a lot of running up and down the aisle that night. And then in addition to Original Screenplay for Baker, he also won for Editing. Just a brief bio on him, if folks are not familiar with Sean Baker. He has been getting a lot of critical and what I call art house recognition in recent years, films like Tangerine and The Florida Project and Red Rocket. These are very much independent, certainly independent-minded films, and oftentimes involve people on the edge or margins of society, specifically sex workers. So it's edgy subject matter in various ways, and Anora is true to that. Let me quickly jump in and state that mine is a minority opinion. I could appreciate Anora for its strengths, but I've got to say I was not a member of the fan club for it, and in several respects. First of all, the basic storyline is Mikey Madison plays a stripper in a Manhattan club, and she's going to fall in love with, well, I won't even use the word fall in love with, she'll fall in with, she'll fall in with one of her clients named Ivan. And what happens very quickly here is that's the milieu, if you will, in terms of that kind of a club in the city in Manhattan. But the fact that in terms of residentially where people hang out, where they live, that this is very much the Russian emigre community in Brighton Beach. So it's you know, and a lot of the scenery, if you will, is Coney Island in wintertime, that kind of milieu. And so it's essentially then that relationship between her character, Anora, that's the character, goes by Annie as a certain shortened form, Ivan, and so there's certainly a mob element there, a Russian mob element there, and then it's all the, you know, the transactional qualities here. Is it just for material wealth and comfort? Is there affection? Is there this or that? Okay, so what are my reservations? Well, one of my major reservations is that even though 139 minutes is not a long running time by superhero standards, it is you know, the other side of 2 hours, as we like to say, and I just felt that the film was too long oftentimes. And that led to my second major reservation, which is that it was sort of, you know, grinding my face in it. And I put that rather crudely because the film itself is crude in a lot of ways. And thematically, I just felt like it was bludgeoning home the same few points. You know, like many scenes were just reiterations of scenes I had already watched. And believe me, I do watch a lot of R-rated movies. I'm no stranger to tough subject matter, but I just felt like it was sometimes almost relentless with the way it pushed that home. And so ultimately, my reaction to Anora was frankly kind of a reactionary, even because so many people were praising it. And I just felt it was overhyped. I just thought it wasn't worth all that. And I thought what happened there essentially was that people, in effect, were voting for edginess, just like that somehow was au courant. You know, let's go for that. Whereas I thought there were actually much more accomplished films made during the year. I mean, just to grind my point home even further, I'll be heavy-handed, just as the film is. You know, it is a striking screenplay. It is a striking performance, the central performance. It has strengths that way. But should the film win for original screenplay? I mean, I just felt like it's sort of a situation where people cuss each other out at great length. And yeah, it's convincing, but, you know, I've been around that before and I can use those words too. So having uttered those words, or almost, let me turn it back to you for your basic take on not just Anora the film, but on essentially cleaning up in so many major categories.
Well, I'm really glad that you put it that way, because I agree completely. I came into the movie with, you know, everything everybody was saying about it. I thought, well, that sounds like kind of an edgy story. A stripper falls in love with a rich Russian guy and gets swept off her feet. It started off like Pretty Woman, and then it turned into Uncut Gems. I found that really jarring. And I know, you know, it's probably intentional, like set it up so people think that they know what's coming, but then, you know, pull the rug out. I respect a lot of the choices the director made. I did think it was very well directed. I did not think the screenplay was really all that much. I thought the central performance was wonderful. She was a very engaging, likable character, even though, you know, she comes from a world I don't know nothing about. But I just felt that in the end, it felt, like you said, like it was being rewarded for edginess. And there were better movies out there. I think it cleaned up too much. I think it's actually there's going to be a backlash. Because my thought is, I don't think that a lot of people I know, if they watch it, they get, oh, it's the best picture. I don't think they're going to like the movie.
Well, it's so reassuring to hear that you're not familiar with that world. So I'm starting to wonder, but it's so reassuring to hear that. But Marie, you touch on a few points worth a little further discussion. One is the very structure of the film. It's been described as a three-act structure. And this is one of the things I think that threw you and that I wondered about too. The first part essentially is romance, and Pretty Woman has been mentioned by a lot of people. It has that quality to it, like a dirtier version of Pretty Woman, if you will, right? You know, in terms of what happens if you fall in love with, you know, whether a stripper or a hooker, however you want to describe these situations. And, you know, that leads one to think that it will have a somehow happier, resolved ending, you know, because you're thinking like light comedy, essentially, with a little bit of edge. The second act would be what's been described as screwball comedy, just because the extremity of the situation, the disparate backgrounds and relationships and so on. And the third act would be drama, if you will, where because after all, when you mess with the Russian mob, at some point they come for you, right? And yes, that's a gun that the guy's carrying. And so it can lead you into, you know, risk or potential risk that way. So that's, you know, something in terms of the structure. As to how it's actually then crafted, I thought some of the transitions were a bit rough that way. That's why in terms of the editing or the sequencing, I wasn't always totally with it that way. I thought sometimes it was pushing things in a kind of arbitrary way, but that's very subjective on my part. But the one thing that's not subjective that you can objectively find or not find in the screenplay is there is very little backstory for these characters. And I admit right up front that there are some films where I'm not at all bothered by that. I'm in the present moment and I actually like a little bit of mystery or uncertainty, or, you know, not, I don't want to have every I dotted and every T crossed. I'm usually good with that. There are other times, and this is one of those times, where I just felt like I wanted to know more about these people. If I'm going to spend more than 2 hours with them at all kinds of parties and all kinds of, you know, hanging out on the street situations, at some point, you don't need like a big full explanatory speech. Here's who I am and my background. But you need to have at least glimmers of something more than you get here. This film is so thoroughly immersed in the moment, and very convincingly, for better or for worse, that it doesn't really bother with, doesn't care about, well, you know, who was she before? And so, yeah, I don't need to know where she went to high school, but you know, I would like to have some additional information that way. And that's where a really good screenplay will give you at least hints, clues, glimmers of that, because people will do that in conversation. I'm not going to make a full confession, but they'll say something very quickly that lets you know, and let you, even if it's just letting your imagination go in a certain direction, who is this person or who was this person? Let me ask you about that point specifically, because it just seemed to me that the film ultimately was like really superficial. I felt like I wasn't, spending more time with them wasn't better time with them.
Oh, I agree with you completely. I liked the way they were trying to set up these, you know, views of social inequities and all these people on the fringes trying to live the American dream. There were moments. I mean, it had its moments, but in terms of like unfolding in a way that kept me engaged, I don't know. I mean, they could have cut out that last half an hour by just maybe editing 40 of the sex scenes. I mean, I understand it's about a sex worker and a stripper. And of course, there's going to be that, and there's going to be some nudity. But I just felt like some of it just could have been implied in terms of beating us over the head with something. I just felt like that took up way too much of the story, because obviously it didn't even need to be shown. That doesn't enhance, you know, the forward motion of the plot. And also I didn't think that the humor, I found that kind of hard to watch, because I mean, when things are funny, they're funny. But when you're watching somebody try so hard to be funny, in my theater, no one laughed at jokes I knew were supposed to be jokes. How was it in your theater, Mike?
Well, again, the audience was not exactly responding to it as comedy. So whether that they just didn't find it funny, or somehow just didn't get the joke, or had fallen asleep, or what, I don't know. I can't speak to their silence, in other words. But I do know, you know, critically, and certainly in terms of awards, it has cleaned up. I mean, there are a lot of people who are enthusiastic about the film. But again, I keep hammering home that point that the film itself is always hammering home. There's a thematic heavy-handedness to it there. So even the jokes tend to be rather leaden. But of course, one could say, and this is getting into like almost on like ethnic humor or jokes, but are the Russians noted for their humor? I mean you know, I mean, that gets into like ethnic stereotypes. It's like sometimes people will watch a German comedy and say, I didn't realize the Germans made comedies, you know, and so I teach German film history, so we run through that. But the funny thing is, like, when I'm teaching Russian film history courses, we watch so many war movies, all the World War II movies and all, that, you know, they're not typically known for a lighter touch in the comedies. And at least that's my very American perspective on it. But twisting it or turning it to direct advantage here, I think in the film there are scenes that are meant to be funny. And I think you're right, Maria. I think that, you know, they're leaning on jokes that really aren't that funny, either because it's not funny or because it's like really a kind of sleazy, dangerous environment. And if I laugh, it's what I call nervous laughter, you know, or defensive laughter. But not ha ha, I think it's really funny. And that's why when it moves into that screwball comedy phase, that's where the film started to lose me, really, because it's meant to be amusing and cute and all that. And I thought, well, if this is cute, I guess it's cute in the early 21st century, but it's not the way a screwball comedy would have been in the 1930s. And it's just, to me, it just seems like taking a genre or flirting with a genre, but with subject matter that, you know, is so seamy that it just doesn't, for me, quite work. I think, and I can't psychoanalyze the writer director on this one, but I think he realizes it's an extreme situation, and extreme situations can lead to humor. It can lead to comedy, just when you get disparate character types and yes, defensive laughter, like, oh my goodness, look what's happening here. How should I respond? We often do laugh at things like that just to protect ourselves, if not the characters. So I don't know. Do you want to say more on this? Because I think that's actually one of the major failings in the film, is that it's not as entertaining in that respect as it assumes itself to be.
Well, for example, there's a running gag about a concussion. And every time it came up, I just like flunk. Like, I know that's supposed to be funny. I just didn't think it landed. But I do, before we move on to the next, because we could talk all day about this movie. I could not stop thinking about the Fellini movie, Knights of Cabiria. Some of the same kind of ideas, but of course, you know, it's Fellini. I mean, you can't expect Sean Baker to be Fellini, but...
Well, it's also Julieta Messina. I mean, it's just you know, perfect casting that way. The Fellini film I love dearly, and that's an interesting discussion, actually, to put these films one next to the other there. The Fellini film is a lot easier to watch, and it's not just that it's quote-unquote cleaner that way, but it also, it's really fluid. It really flows beautifully. The scenes are well-constructed, and the action flows along, and it's a real character study, and I felt like I understood her character more. Julieta Messina's character more than I understand this character. And that's a very subjective assessment, but I really felt, I'll readily admit, not just a matter of knowing her better, if you will, but liking her more mm-hmm. sympathetic. And I would not rule out audience sympathy in terms of how people respond to a film. And Knights of Cabiria is quite endearing in places, even though if you're hard-nosed and pragmatic about it, what is her profession? How does she spend her nights? So, you know, it's not so different than what we see here, really.
Yeah, but somehow that movie is just more lyrical. Like I said, I mean, it's Fellini, what are we talking about? But it is weird to me that a movie like Anora is being so celebrated when I feel like it was already done better by somebody else. All right, so Mike, let's move on to The Brutalist. And can we just say up front that the 3.5-hour runtime, the intermission and the previews, you're talking about 4 hours trapped in a chair. That is brutal.
Oh, so we're not going to talk brutalist architecture. Well, the brutalist architecture of the chair.
There's right. So much brutalism.
we were going to talk about Marcel Breuer and brutalist chairs. And I guess you're talking about the theater chairs too. But just to actually on a programming note, back in the day, go back to like the 50s and 60s with what were called roadshow attractions. Think of like the really big musicals or biblical epics, things like that. They often did have running times. And of course, Gone with the Wind, you're getting on 4 hours of screen time. They typically would have an intermission. And you know, those were back in the days when you'd have an overture beforehand, the musical overture, you'd have an intermission. So that's not an unheard of phenomenon. It is unusual nowadays to do that, because when you think about some of the really long films, and yes, Martin Scorsese and others, some of the really long films we've had in recent years, or the superhero movies, when they start to tip over 3 hours, usually they just keep going. And I'm fine. I mean, I'm in my seat. Yeah, I'll be here another 20 minutes. I got my seatbelt on. I'm settled in. But it begs the question sometimes, you know, should there be an intermission? I got to say, with this film, the intermission hits at the right moment. It's a biographical picture in terms of our main character and in his life, where he is at that point and so on. It really does hit at the right moment. And so if you're going to take an intermission, that is the place to take it. But it leads actually to my major reservation about, and there's a lot of strength in this film. There's a lot that is really, really admirable. But my main reservation is that if I'm being hard-nosed about it or brutal about it, it seems to me that this is a film that doesn't need to be 3.5 hours long. When I think about the character and his life story and the overall situation, it's powerful material. I'm not denying that. But I keep thinking, gee, you could do this in 2.5 hours, not 3.5. But I've had a mental wrestling match with this film ever since I saw it. So even though I feel confident in saying that, it doesn't need to be that long. Okay, where's the wrestling match? Then I tell myself, okay, what would I cut? What would I take out? The film is so extremely well made at the level of production design and costuming and direction and editing, you know, all the tech categories. It's just, and acting, of course, it's so beautifully made that I would be like loath to cut out certain scenes. Like, well, no, keep that scene. I love that scene. Well, how about that one? No, that's a pretty good scene too. And so you can understand how I'm wrestling back and forth on that. What exactly would I take out? I think in the second half of the film, there are some sections of it that could use tightening for sure. But I'm not fully resolved on this issue of what, you know, what to do there in a case of a film that's long and maybe didn't need to be that long. Now, since we are talking Oscars for this program in terms of the Academy Awards ceremony that you and I are speaking about just a few days afterwards, this film won 3 Oscars. Adrian Brody won for his portrayal of Laszlo Toth, the brutalist architect. And it is a really, really strong performance, to use that word again. And it's his second Academy Award, you know, his best actor. So he's in that kind of elite category. You know, he's nipping at the heels of Daniel Day-Lewis, I guess. He's on his way. And I also like Daniel Day-Lewis. He's very selective about his roles. He doesn't do a lot of films, really. He's kind of picky that way, and he picks some good ones. So anyway, the first Oscar was for best actor. The second one was for Lowell Crawley's cinematography. And it really is an exceptionally well-shot film. That's one reason why I don't want to cut anything. The third one was actually Daniel Blumberg's music. And it is a really effective musical score. So I'm actually happy with all three of those Oscar wins. I think those are the strengths of the film in a lot of ways. How about you?
I agree absolutely with deserved every one of those Oscars. Adrien Brody is amazing. But when trying to figure out what to cut, I'm with you. The cinematography is amazing. And it's hard to, you know, get rid of anything that works. But I do think it's a little bit self-indulgent in that it holds certain frames just too long. Like the scene where Laszlo meets his cousin Attila and they embrace. I mean, that scene went on for, I don't know, an hour and a half. It just seemed, it took too long. It made the point. And then it lingered and it lingered and it lingered and it. With a runtime that long, you have to be really careful that you don't bore people. And yes, it's a visual feast in so many ways, but the underlying story is a downer. And that's a long time to sit with a downer of a story. And I'm making it sound like it's not watchable. It's watchable, but I don't think there are very many people who would watch it again.
Well, that's a really good observation because it's an example of a film that I admire. But I'm not particularly eager to watch it again. Mm-hmm. There's some really great films that as soon as I see them, I could sit down, and I've done this before years ago, and with Fellini, actually, I think of it, you know, where you're watching a film and it's over and they go, let's stay for the next show kind of thing. And they like to watch it again. I would not want to spend, you know, my entire day with The Brutalist that way. But I think you also make a very good point about some of the scenes that could use tightening. Because there are crucial scenes, you know, this is a Holocaust story, and as he endures the worst of that in Europe and comes to America and stays with his cousin and where the life goes from there. Each of those life segments, of course, is crucial, is compelling even. And yet once this director gets inside a scene, he seems hesitant to leave the scene. And that's a really good point that you make. Because I really was intrigued by the scenes where he's come to America. And actually, for me, the highlight technically in the film is after all the horrors of what he's experienced in World War II, when he gets on the boat and comes to America, that was so compelling. It was the upside down shot of the Statue of Liberty, that when you're so disoriented and so ill and just so out of it in a lot of ways, as you come to America, what's your perception? What do you see? Yeah, the usual Ellis Island sort of thing, you know, Statue of Liberty, but it's upside down. And the fact that his whole world is upside down, it's topsy-turvy. And that sequence is handled relatively quickly, and it works well for that reason. But then once he gets to the States and then down to Philadelphia, as an architecture buff, I was interested by the fact that because of this architect's background, after all, he had studied at the Bauhaus, which was shut down by the Nazis because it was modernist and it was, you know, corrupt and degenerate, to use the word that they used for so much modern art. The fact that, you know, that was his background, though, he'd studied there. And brutalism as an architecture style grows out of, it's kin to the Bauhaus. And so in America, that's his sensibility coming in. So when he goes to Philadelphia, which is not chosen by accident in the sense that his cousin, when you mentioned the cousin in Attila, has a furniture store. And there's some wonderful detail there by way of ethnographic insights, as in, you know, these are Jewish people who in some cases have been in the country a while, in other cases just came over as, you know, refugees from Holocaust Europe. And so anyway, the cousin's been in Philadelphia and he changes his name. The cousin calls the store Miller and Sons. I mean, like, give him, you know, the usual anglicizing, give himself an Anglo name. He doesn't have sons really, but Americans like that. So the furniture store is Miller and Sons. These are really, really perceptive observations. And of course, you know, our architect is taking all this in. So anyway, he goes to work there. And he's a furniture designer as much as an architect at that point. Well, his cousin has been selling colonial revival furniture because the colonial revival period, think back like Williamsburg in the 20s and the 30s and 40s and into the 50s, you know, colonial revival was so patriotic, so American, just so found everywhere in the States at that point. And of course, our architect is kind of Lasso kind of puzzled by this, like, that's not the way he would design a chair. That's not how he would. And he actually tells his cousin at one point, they're walking through the story, he says, you know, but you know, you have all this furniture, you make money, but nothing's very attractive. It's not very nice. Kind of, and boy, what a put down, but so direct as he explains his aesthetic. And what he wants to do then is take that kind of furniture and give it a modernist twist. And that's where he starts designing chairs that Marcel Breuer would recognize as a prototypical brutalist architect. So I think this is a film that will be absolutely fascinating for anybody in architecture school. I realize that's an audience of 35, but for people who do go to architecture school, it really is. It's a really smart film in terms of architecture history. Because then when he goes to work for a wealthy client, and I don't want to spoil much in the story, but essentially bringing that aesthetic to a more traditional and very wealthy American household. And there are all sorts of like really, really rich sociological observations there. And at the production design level, it's beautifully realized in terms of the contrast of different architectural and interior design aesthetics. It's really, really terrific there. But Marie's point is so powerfully the case here that once you have that established, there are just too many scenes that just sort of soak in that. And if you have a scene that goes on for 10 or 15 minutes, you could get the same point across in half that time.
You know, one thing I wanted to mention about the era of movies like Gone with the Wind, where people wanted a saga, they wanted a spec, they got all the credits out of the way up front. You didn't have to wait for 8 minutes after the movie was over to find out every single person who worked on it. That's one difference that makes movies much longer. And it's not, you're not getting movie, you're just getting credits. There were moments in this movie I thought were brilliant. That scene of where they unveil the beginnings of the library and have all the light coming. And it's like, that's such a beautiful Citizen Kane moment. There were moments like they're standing outside the furniture store looking at the things in the window. Just felt like such a Paul Thomas Anderson moment. I could see him running with that. Kind of alluded to the Guy Pearce character, who I thought actually may have turned in an even better performance than Adrian Brody. And finally, Mike, I wanted to ask, when you were watching it, I couldn't have stopped thinking about Ayn Rand's The Fountainhead.
Yeah, The Fountainhead is a definite point of reference for anything like this. And you've mentioned some of the other films that would relate to it. And I think even also Barry Levinson's Avalon, really, in terms of just the overall immigrant experience, you know, Jews from Eastern Europe coming to America, in that case, coming at the turn of the 20th century, not after the Holocaust, but still, those issues of assimilation, those who came here first and started to assimilate, those who've arrived more recently, just different standards of living, if you will, different expectations. You know, that's great subject matter for a film. And obviously The Fountainhead in terms of a specifically architecture oriented story. And that's actually what held my interest more than anything else, was as a kind of architectural history. And I'm, you know, totally pulled in by the compelling subject matter, you know, obviously with the Holocaust, but the lens through which it's told is very much an aesthetic lens of if you were a Bauhaus-trained architect and what you went through coming to the States. It really, really is perceptive there. It's just, as we keep saying, it could be a lot tighter in the telling. And so the reason I'm still hesitant to cut some of the scenes I even just said we should cut is just, you know, like shot by shot, it's just a gorgeous film. It looks so nice. I wouldn't want to be, you know, this is an old fashioned reference, but like, it's sort of like, are you the one with the scissors? You know, you're going to cut out this or that. You know what I mean? That seems brutal, doesn't it? Well, let me take the scissors to these frames and take them out. I want it done, but I'm not sure I want to be wielding the scissors at that point.
Yeah, I'm with you. I don't want to be the scissor person either. All right, final point, Mike, the epilogue. Good idea, or one more instance to just beat us over the head with the themes?
Yeah, it's a kind of thematic overkill, probably at that point. I just think the film's established certain things really well, and that's a good question. Should it be there at all? But if it were to go away, if it were to disappear, would we notice the absence? I always put it that way in cases like, you know what I mean? Like you can argue the merits of an epilogue, but what if it sometimes like just disappeared?
But it almost seems too facile. Like why not just hint at the reveal throughout the whole movie? There's just something so book report about standing up at the end to tell you, like, you, in case you didn't get it.
Well, yeah, that's a really good point you make, is that information should come through either clearly or at least implied in the film and then leave off where you leave off. And yeah, Book Report's a good way to put it, because it did seem like for those slow viewers out there who didn't quite pick up on things, we are here now to tell you that. And I did feel not quite resentful there, but I just felt like it essentially wasn't needed. And I'm almost thinking like either take it out or just recalibrate it a bit. But you're right, it's a bit too heavy-handed there.
Well, that does bring us to the end of this episode. Don't forget to check out our other episodes at atmhcc.podbean.com. And we'll see you next time at the movies.
See you then.
Thank you for listening to Dragon Podcast. You can find this episode and all other Howard Community College podcasts available for your listening pleasure on all streaming platforms, as well as Podbean at podbean.com/dragonpodcast. Thank you for listening.